The portion of Matthew chapter 4 that we're looking at this morning is the third of the three tests that Christ underwent in the wilderness, and we read about it in Matthew chapter 4, verses 8 to 11. Here are the words that we look at this morning, temptation or test number 3. Matthew chapter 4, verse 8, again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, that is, Satan said to Jesus, all these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. Then Jesus said to him, begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and were ministering to him. And with that is the conclusion of this part of his life we call Christ in the wilderness, the temptations of Christ, or as we've seen already, the tests that Christ passed in the wilderness before launching out in his great public work. We're going to look at the third test in detail and see what application it has to our lives, what difference it should make at how we look at September and the months to come in just a moment. But before that, I'd like us to look at the third as part of the three, look at the whole thing together now that we've made it to the conclusion of verses 1 to 11. And let me make for you three overall observations about the whole idea of being taunted or tempted or tested by the devil. For surely one of the benefits of this passage is for us to be aware, us to become aware of what to expect from the devil and his agents, the other demons and his people, those who speak for the devil in the world, when they seek to derail us, then when they seek to trouble us about our intention of living lives of obedience to Christ. Let me make three overall observations, not taking too much time, I think, and then we'll get to looking at the third temptation. All right, let's think about this. Observation number one, for bait, we've talked about the fact that the devil uses bait in his temptations. For bait, the devil uses promises he can't keep. You'll notice in the graphic that the hook is empty. There isn't any bait, but there seems to be bait because the devil promises tasty little morsels, if only you will take the hook in your mouth. For bait, the devil uses promises he can't keep. By definition, the devil is a deceiver. He is a liar. He's the father of lies. You can count on him to not speak the truth and need to count on him to be not speaking the truth when he dangles some pretty little thing in front of you and says, you could have this if only you will disobey God. For bait, the devil uses promises he can't keep. We need to know that. We need to be aware of that. I wonder if you are aware of that. I wonder if in the temptations that are presently threatening to undo you, in the tests that you're undergoing in the world in regard to whether or not you're going to keep obeying God or not, you're aware of what bait the devil is lying about, what he's promising to give you when in fact he's not able to give you anything. You see, to the temptations of Christ, he offered him bread, but he couldn't give Jesus bread, so he had to try to get Jesus to make the bread. And so with the other temptations as well, he wasn't in the position to give what he offered. He made promises he couldn't keep. That's how the devil works, and sometimes he works very effectively. Here's observation number two. When the bait doesn't work, the devil switches to bigger bait. We need to know this, because we might be resisting some particular kind of temptation and thinking, I just got to get over my tendency to swallow that hook, to give in to that temptation, to cave in on that level, and not realize that it might be that the result of successfully refusing that temptation is a more enticing temptation, because this is the tactics of the devil. When the bait doesn't work, the devil switches to bigger bait. And it's worth noticing here the idea of bait getting bigger and bigger and more enticing, that each of the three things that the devil offered Jesus were things that were legitimate in themselves. Bread when he was hungry, nothing wrong with bread when you're hungry, unless you've been commanded by God to fast. And angelic deliverance from disaster by which he could launch his public ministry. Neither of those parts of the second temptation were wrong in themselves, but they were bigger than the first bit of bait. And in this third temptation, all the kingdoms of the world and its glory, it wasn't wrong for Christ to want all the kingdoms of the world and all the glory. He was, after all, on an assignment from God. He was God on assignment to reclaim the kingdoms of the world and to gain the glory that the world was created to give him. So the bait wasn't in itself wrong, but what we're noticing is that each piece of bait got bigger when he refused the one before. We better know about that. We better be aware of that. And if that seems daunting because it looks like you're going to spend the rest of your life getting tempted in more and more spectacular ways, there's another observation to make from our text today. Number three, when the fish really refuses, that would be you and me really refusing, the devil cuts bait and moves on. But he doesn't cut bait and move on. He doesn't leave off the temptations until he hears you emphatically refusing. So you see this in our text. Verse 10, Matthew 4:10, Jesus said to him, "Begone, Satan, for it's written," and he quotes from Deuteronomy once again. But there's this very emphatic refusal, "Begone, Satan," and we read in verse 11, "Then the devil left him." And so if we are inclined to be discouraged about the fact that the devil is going to tempt us with tasty little morsels, promising us things he can't give, and if we are successful in refusing the disaster that would come from biting onto the hook, he'll give us more tasty promises, more tasty enticements. If that's discouraging, we should be encouraged by the fact that he's on a strict time budget. And the devil has some scruples against wasting time. And as soon as you identify yourself as a waste of his time, you can look forward to the experience of him leaving. And this is what we're taught when James the apostle and Peter the apostle instruct us in how to deal with temptation. For example, James chapter 4, verse 7, this is a happy thing. James says, "Submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." Now we're looking at the second part of the statement. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. But we dare not detach the second sentence from the first, because the way you resist the devil is not simply to say, quote Jesus, and say, "Begone, Satan," and then work on your articulation, work on your enunciation so you say it really impressively. It's not a matter of how you say what you say, and it's hardly a matter of what you say. It's a matter of what you mean. And the "begone, Satan" that we're striving for, the resisting the devil, which will cause the devil to flee from us, needs to be words you speak in regard to your commitment to submit yourself to God. It's your determination to do what God calls you to do. It's your commitment to obeying God. It's your faith that causes the devil to flee. So resisting the devil is a matter of saying no to his temptation, but it's way more than getting the words right. It's way more than picking your words carefully. It's a matter of meaning the words. But this is a happy thing. If you can really refuse the devil, he'll mark you as a waste of time and he will leave you alone. In fact, you know, terms of the practical application, one of the ways you can determine that the temptations you were undergoing were demonic, were from the devil, is how decisively they end when you get really serious about refusing them. If it comes up from your flesh, from your own sinfulness, it might take a long time to get over it. You got to break old habits. If it comes from the world, well, similarly, the solution, the conclusion of the temptation might be sort of gradual. But when it's the devil or his agents, when it's demons taunting you, one of the ways you deduce that it was demons is just how quickly the thing ends when you get serious about refusing. And so we can be happy about that. But while we're being happy that there's such a thing as being left alone by the devil, we should be careful not to be stupidly happy. We need to be careful. And so when we switch from James to Peter, we see the need to be watchful. Peter says, along the same lines of resisting the devil, he says in 1 Peter chapter 5, "Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour." So here's the same instruction. Resist him, firm in your faith. And the implication is what James lays out clearly. If you will resist him, if you will stay firm in your faith, committed to obeying God and trusting him enough to obey him, if you refuse the devil, then you don't need to worry about him for a while. But it would be stupidly happy of you to say, "Well, I'm glad that's over with. Don't have to worry about that temptation anymore." Because as the devil recognizes you as a waste of time, he may come back. His agents may come back to see if you're still a waste of time or whether or not you've become a promising prospect, a fish that's likely to bite. So when we compare Matthew's account of the temptations or the tests of Christ to Luke's account, it's in chapter 4 of the Gospel of Luke. It's interesting to notice that as the devil leaves Jesus in the temptations, Luke talks about it this way, Luke 4:13, "And when the devil had ended every temptation," that is every temptation for the time being, he departed from him, the devil departed from Jesus, until an opportune time. This is why we need to be careful to be watchful. This is why we need to be careful to be sober-minded, because we may neatly escape the attention of the devil by refusing him so emphatically, but it's a temporary break, which is one of the reasons why we learn to long for heaven when we are free of the schemes of the devil. But we can be temporarily free if we will be dogmatically emphatic in refusing him. And these are observations for our benefit that I think can be made safely from Matthew chapter 4 and the account of Christ in the wilderness. But having put that in place, now let's get to the actual business at hand and look at the third test. The first one was about love. Turning the stone into bread came down to an issue of what do you love the most? And the second temptation had to do with trust. Do you trust God enough to obey him? The temptation to not launch his ministry the way the devil suggested he launch it, by throwing himself off the pinnacle and having angels rescue him from dashing his foot against a stone, was an issue of trust, doing God's thing God's way. This morning, the issue is worship, as seen from the fact that what the devil says to Jesus is, Matthew chapter 4, this is in the middle of verses 8 to 11, all these I will give you, all the kingdoms of the world and all their glory I will give you if you fall down and worship me. There's something totally audacious about, totally crazy about this, the devil talking to Jesus, who was God in the flesh, and saying, I will give you the world if you will worship me. But that was the nature of the test. It's a test about worship. The question of the moment was, who was Jesus willing to worship? Who was he willing to bow down before if the whole world was at stake? And so the practical question for us, the personal question in regard to the life that we are living in these days, is the same. The question is, who are you willing to worship? What's your price? Who would you give your worshipful allegiance to if the whole world was offered you? Notwithstanding the fact that if the whole world was offered you, it would be a lie. There is no real bait. The bait are promises that the devil can't keep. But the question is the same. Who am I worshiping? And I want you to notice two things about the question of worship before we explore the answer. Two things about worship, the question of worship, the question of who you're worshiping. In the first place, you need to know, this is a question for everybody. There's no begging off on this. You can't say, oh, who do I worship? I'm off the hook. I'm not a worshipful kind of guy. I'm not religious. You can't do that. You can't save this question for your religious friends and say, I'm just not sort of religious. I feel a little funny talking to this crowd because look at you on a Labor Day weekend, you're at church. I mean, how religious can you get? But if you are here, you know, under dire straits or something, you're bribing some family member by coming here so that you can go somewhere else later on, whatever, this would be none of my business. You can't get off the hook here. You can't say, no, you know, I don't worship anyone. I'm not religious. Because in actual fact, well, this is how the Bible sees you, created as you are in the very image of God, you have within you the tendency, the impulse to recognize worth when you see it. And recognizing worth is the essence of worship. And you can't do life as a human being without attaching some sort of central worth to something. So whether or not you consider yourself to be religious, whether or not your friends and loved ones would think of you as a religious person, in actual fact, you are a worshiper. This is a question for everybody. What is it that you attach the primary worth of your life to? That's one thing to notice about the question of worship. Second thing to notice, it's a personal question. This, too, comes from the fact that we're created in the image of God. So we've been given a rational soul. We've been given an identity. We've been given a personality. We are persons created in the image of the three-personed God. So the question of worth, the question of worship, is a personal question. I could say it this way. The whole notion of what it is that you attach worth to, what it is you're living for, always is attached to the question of who you're living for, who you attach worship to, because we're persons. So the issue is personal. There's always a who attached to the question of what it is that you're worshiping. So with that in mind, let's look together under the heading of the question of worship at three choices that all of us face regarding who you're going to live for, who you're going to ascribe worth to, who you're going to worship. Did you know the word worship in modern English is just a condensing of the old English word worth-ship? That's what worship means, worth-ship, worthiness. Who you worship is who you put worth upon. It's just that over the centuries, people trying to say worth-ship real fast ended up saying worship, and we're glad they did. Okay, three choices regarding who you live for, what you attach worth to. Three answers to the personal question of who is it you're living for. Here's the first, the obvious one, the default position. You can live for yourself. This is the way broken down, disobedient by nature human beings normally live. Who do you attach the supreme worth of your life to? The default answer is to yourself. You can live for yourself. And it's what the first test was about. Because when Jesus was very hungry after 40 days and 40 nights of fasting, and Satan came to him and suggested that he turn the stones into bread, and he refused, he was demonstrating that there were more important things in his life, that he put worth on something far above the worth he put on staying alive and satisfying his hunger and addressing the fact that he was starving to death. This is what the first test was about. Jesus passed the test brilliantly. Not just in the wilderness, but at other times. We saw this. This is a review. He said, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work." This is how Jesus proceeded. More important than satisfying his appetite for food, which is, under the circumstances, more important than staying alive when he was starving, was the accomplishment of God's work. He was not living for himself. What a different story it would have been if he was. But what a different story all of us are telling by our lives if, in fact, we're taking this God-given life that we live and living it for ourselves. You can live for yourself, and many, many people do. Bottom line, they suit themselves, do what they want, because they themselves are the most important things in their lives. And I want you to see this morning with me that that's a dangerous way to live. Never mind the fact that everybody does it, it's dangerous. Kind of like driving on the weekend, driving on the highway in the long weekend. It's really, really dangerous, but everybody does it. And living for yourself is dangerous. It can lead to all kinds of difficulties and disaster. In fact, it's not too strong to say that living for yourself can drive you crazy. Considering what we've been created to be, living for yourself is a form of insanity. And we have illustrations of that in real life. Perhaps you have illustrations of that among your acquaintances as you see people doing the most disastrous things to suit themselves. And we see examples in the Bible. We're thinking about Christ in the wilderness, so we ought to be comparing it to the people of God in the wilderness. We've been doing this over the last couple of weeks. Think about the children of Israel. Think about the nation of God in the wilderness at the time when Moses had gone up the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments. And what happened? It's recorded in Exodus chapter 32. I'll leave to you to read it to yourself sometime. Exodus chapter 32. So here's the story. Moses has gone up the mountain to receive the Ten Commandments. And these people were in such a privileged circumstance. They had miraculously been delivered from slavery after being slaves and their ancestors before them for centuries. Through 10 amazing demonstrations of the power of God, the plagues upon the Egyptians, God delivered Israel from slavery, and now they're free, and they have the promise of the land of milk and honey ahead of them. And they have just entered into a blood covenant with God, with the living God. They've just entered into the most solemn binding agreement possible between two parties. They've just become God's covenant partners with all the privileges packed into that. And Moses is up on the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments by which they are able to benefit from all the blessings that God heaps upon the obedient. The Ten Commandments were the key to a prosperous life, for God blesses obedience as he curses disobedience. So they're in this terrific position. But Moses takes 40 days to get the Ten Commandments, and that gets old. So in Exodus 32, the people say to Aaron, Moses' brother, who's left in charge, "And this is too long, and we don't know what happened to Moses, so make us a god we can worship." And Aaron, tragically, instructs them all to take off their earrings, and they all take off their earrings, men and women, and they melt them down in a pot, and out of the molten gold, Aaron shapes a beautiful golden calf to worship. and they bow down before it, and they worship, and they say, this is more like it. These are the sorts of gods we worship back in the good old days in Egypt. Just think about that. Think about the insanity of suiting yourself rather than following God. They had all of these privileges and this brilliant future before them, and they gave it all away for what? For a really expensive statue of a cow. Is that bizarre? They could have had God. They got a gold statue of a cow. Really shiny. Very lifelike. Ooh, it's female. I mean, they were absolutely stupid. This is the insanity of suiting yourself. I wonder if you've seen anything like that in your life. Have you seen anybody do something stupid like that? A good life, a brilliant future, and to give it all away for a really expensive statue of a cow? We see that all the time. It's what comes from living for yourself. It's a disaster, and it's dangerous. So let's consider our options. Three choices regarding who to live for. You can live for yourself, or B, you can live for others, which sounds like a significant upgrade. Live for other people rather than living for yourself. But I want to show you that it sounds better than it is, and it might be as much trouble as living for yourself. It might be. Here are some thoughts about living for others. On the one hand, living for others can sound more virtuous than it is. It can seem really, really virtuous. It can sound virtuous and be way more virtuous sounding than it is. Because in actual fact, living for another person or living for others can be very self-focused. Please listen carefully. I'm not saying that it always is. I'm not saying that people who live for others are intrinsically selfish. Just saying that they might be. I mean, think of some stereotypes. Think about a stage parent. Think about a sports dad. Think about a man who sees that his son could be a really good golfer and devotes the next 15 years of his life to seeing that his son realizes his dreams and becomes the next Tiger Woods. Now, is that unselfish on the father's part, or is it selfish? This is complicated. Like last week's complications, because we're talking motives. But all I'm asking you to see right now is that it's distinctly possible that a man could be very, very self-centered in trying to make a Tiger Woods of his son, trying to make a Sidney Crosby of his son, or a gold medal figure skater of his daughter, or whatever it would be. It could be self-focused. He could be thinking about how great it would be to be, you know, Walter Gretzky if only his son would be Wayne Gretzky. Make all those commercials and all those residuals and, you know, live in a cottage. And if my son was a billionaire, it'd be handy. It could be that, right? And it could be some sort of combination of genuine unselfishness and selfishness. It could be, you know, the vicarious thing, just, you know, seeing your child live your dream. And it's not just parents and children who fall into this trap of potentially being far less virtuous than you look. Think about a person totally devoted to the well-being of his aging parents. And it might be love of parents that drives all the sacrifice, but who knows what it is, really? I mean, we're talking about motives. It could be that the caregiving grown child is just totally obsessed with the idea of staking out a reputation for himself as an unbelievably devoted caregiver, you know? Maybe he's got a grudge against his siblings and he's trying to show them a thing or two. Who knows what's going on in the heart? Living for others can sound more virtuous than it is. A couple of other notes about living for others. Living for others can be idolatry. Now, it can be sincere and well-intentioned and unselfish and sacrificial and free of all what we've just looked at when it's less virtuous than it seems, but it can still be idol worship. You can make your child's success or your aging parents' comfort or the success of your team. You can make the other people that you are living for your idols. Sometimes it goes like that. We have a great case in point there. If we're looking at the tests of Jesus, we can compare them to other notable tests in the Scripture. There's a very clear mention of testing in Genesis. It's this test that God ran on Abraham in regard to his son whom he loved. Genesis chapter 22 starts like this. After these things, God tested Abraham. He tested him. And here's the test. He said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And he said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. I hope you know the story. It's in Genesis 22 if you need a refresher course or an introduction. In actual fact, God seems to have had no intention that Abraham would ever offer up his son as a burnt offering, but as a test he told him to, and let him get all the way to the place where the knife was about to plunge into the body. And then the angel of the Lord stopped him, and a ram was provided, and a lamb was promised, and there's all sorts of imagery there about the sacrifice of God's own son. But on the surface, it was a test. Abraham loved Isaac. Very first mention of the word love in the Bible. Abraham loved Isaac. So God tested him to see how much he loved him, to see if he was living for Isaac or living through Isaac. It was a test. Living for others can be idolatry. And maybe only through testing do we find out whether it's an idol that we're worshiping or whether it's a person that we're loving. Okay, here's another note about living for others. Living for others can be a burden to the others. Living for others can be a burden to the others. The others can find it a great burden to have someone so devoted to their happiness. Not every other person would complain, but some can. The others that are being lived for should hope that the person living for them gets tested so that we can see, you know, so that they can see, is this idol worship, which would always be disastrous? Or is this just love? You know, like Eve should have hoped that Adam would go to God with her in regard to her disobedience. If Eve had her head on right, she'd say to Adam, take me to God and see what happens next. We don't know that she did, but we think she should have. Similarly, the people who are being lived for should be hoping that the devotion with which someone's living for them would get tested. Because it can be a burden to have someone whose happiness depends upon you, you know, responding properly to their care, especially if their devotion to you is poisoned by selfishness. I picked up on this, actually, in the Screwtape Letters. C.S. Lewis has Screwtape talking about the sort of woman who lives for others. Here's the quotation. She's the sort of woman who lives for others. You can always tell the others by their hunted expression. The sense is that, you know, it's a burden to have someone devoted to your happiness that way. You could hope that they would move on to something else. So what are they going to move on to? If we can live for ourselves, that's disastrous. You can live for others, that's problematic. Or, third option, you can live for God. Two notes about living for God. On the one hand, I mean, you could just take it straight. Living for God is the right thing to do. You don't have to go any further with the rationale. You could just say it's the right thing to do. For the Bible makes it clear that we were created for God, by God. For example, talking about Christ specifically as the creator, Paul says to the Colossians, for by him, that is, by Jesus, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. All things were created through him. All things are created for him. That would include you. Being on earth, being visible, though perhaps you're not a throne or a dominion or a ruler or authority, you're one of the people included in this broad statement. All things, including you and I, were created for him, through him and for him, which means that you are specifically created to live for God. That's what you're created for. It's the right thing to do. And this is the big point to take away as September starts. That the only way to protect yourself from the insanity that is often the result of living for yourself is to find something so much more glorious to live for, that is, find someone so much more glorious to live for, that all of your obligations to yourself and all of your interest in your own appetites and all of your capacities to live for yourself gets tamed by the obvious alternative of devoting yourself to someone far more spectacular than you yourself. Someone you can take far more interest in than you take in yourself. Where are you going to find someone who is so overwhelmingly more important to you than you that all of your interest in you gets tamed? There's really only one candidate. It's the God that, in fact, you were created to worship. But the only safe way to tame our necessary commitments to avoid starving to death by eating bread when we're hungry, and our legitimate desire for the kind of deliverance from difficulties that was part of the second temptation. So the only way to tame our passions and our appetites and our commitments to ourselves is by bringing our commitment to ourselves under the umbrella of a greater commitment to a greater person than ourselves to live for. And what goes for living for ourselves and taming all those desires goes for living for others as well. The only way to tame your obligations to your family, to your spouse, to your children, to your aging parents, to your colleagues, to the guy beat up and robbed on the road to Jericho as you are seeking to be a good Samaritan, the only way to tame all of that is by submitting it to a commitment to someone far more important than your children, your parents, your colleagues, your teammates, and the guy on the road to Jericho. Living for God is the right thing to do. Second note, living for God is the only safe thing to do. So let me try to bring some clarity to this whole muddle caused by the confusion about motives to the idea of living for others. Here's the best case scenario in terms of being a really good married person, a really good spouse, a really good parent, properly devoted to your children, a really good grown child looking after your aging parents, a really good teammate, a colleague, supervisor. Here's the best case scenario. Here's the best thing you could do for the people that you love and are inclined to live for. Live for God instead. Devote yourself to God. And as service to God, give your spouse, and so your marriage, give your kids, all of them, give your parents, give all the people in your life the devotion that God requires you to give as part of your service to God. And your loved ones should hope you do this. Because if you will live for Him and then devote yourself according to His commandments to them as He commands, He will provide you with all the resources you need to do it well. He will give you His love, the love of God poured into our hearts. He will give you His patience and His self-control. He will give you the strength, the wisdom, the discernment to love your wife or your husband properly, productively, in a way that's not a burden to them, but in actual fact, a functional delight to them. And so, best case scenario, you address your responsibilities to yourself. You know, you got to feed yourself and so on. You got to live for yourself in the sense of staying alive, looking after yourself. And then you live for others in the sense of attending to your responsibilities and fulfilling your obligations and being the best parent you can be and the best child you can be and so on. Get on with your duties, but you do it in the name of Jesus. You do it as part of your living for Christ. You do it as obedience to God. And then everyone's a winner. And no one's a loser. And you don't go crazy and give it all up to worship an expensive statue of a cow or become a burden to the people that you're so devoted to. This is the best case scenario. And it applies to everyone in every circumstance who will bow the knee and devote himself to Christ. Even people at the very bottom of a ladder, any ladder, pick a ladder. Pick the social ladder of the first century. At the very bottom of the social ladder in the days when the New Testament was written, were the slaves. And what's really intriguing for us about this is that there were some slaves in the early days of the Christian church who were Christians. And they went to church and worshiped alongside masters who owned slaves. And there's specific instructions to the slaves, which gives us a great idea of how to maintain your composure and meet your obligations, even in a really crummy job. So let's talk about living for others at work. And if you think you got a crummy job, think about the first century slaves. They weren't even considered human. They were considered human facsimiles who could do a person's work without having to be treated with any kind of dignity. And some Christians were slaves. And they were in charge of, you know, scrubbing out the latrines and washing the feet of dirty-footed kind of people coming in from the dirty streets on their way into the orgies and so on. They had terrible jobs. And Paul gives instructions to them. It's in Colossians chapter 3, in one case. Paul says to the slaves, you think you got a crummy job? He says to these people with their crummy job, whatever you do, work heartily, wholeheartedly, as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. You are slaving yourself. You are a slave of the Lord Christ, is what he said. You are Christ's slave. You just look like, you know, Rufus's slave. You're Christ's slave. And if you can serve your master on earth, your crummy boss, as a way of serving Christ, Christ will reward you. And the job will be very different. So whether you're looking after your own kids, or whether you're looking after your own parents, whether you're looking after your team at work or on the field, whether you're serving a cruel Roman slave owner, you can do it for Christ. This is living for God. And this has lots of application to this thing we call September 2008, which is just about to start. Getting back into all the normal routines, with all the normal responsibilities, with all the obligations of life. You can do it all for God, and you should. It's a test. You could seek the world Satan's way by serving him, by worshiping him, by doing things his way. Or you could refuse the devil, and in obedience to Christ, specifically as a servant of Christ, you could do all that you're called to do with his power and pass the tests that the devil brings to you. So now it's time to get practical. And this is the third week that we've been building a list, which are really projects, to take into September and the year ahead. Here's a review. What do? We saw 2 weeks ago in the first test, we should learn to love God most of all by walking with those who do. We looked at that 2 weeks ago. By choosing to associate with people who love God most of all, we can learn to love God most of all, because love tends to be contagious. And one of the obvious applications to that, here comes September, and here comes the rest of the ministry year at West London Alliance Church. I strongly encourage you to explore the possibility of joining some sort of small group so that you can walk with those who love Christ, so that you can be actually connected to people in some sort of loving relationship with God that might rub off on you. Small group would be an obvious application, and there's a number of small groups launching and relaunching. You'll see them talked about in the weeks ahead. Application two from last week. About trust. Learn to trust God more by obeying his commandments more precisely. And an application to that, getting more precise in your obedience to him, learning to trust him, which was what last week was all about, the application would be to set up some sort of arrangement of accountability. And it might be that the small group that you are a part of is based on or includes some notion of accountability, and it might not be. But in addition to getting into some sort of connection with some people, perhaps through a small group, it's just real important to get into relationship accountability where someone can look at the details of your life and challenge you to ramp it up, challenge you to get more precisely obedient. And that's the application from last week. So now here's the application for this week under the heading of worship. Learn to worship God better by making the most, let me be really specific, by making the most of Sunday worship services and a daily personal time with God. The essence of worship, the essence of recognizing the surpassing worth of God, is to devote yourself to him. That's why the word worship shows up in Romans chapter 12, verse 1, where Paul, having explained the whole gospel in chapters 1 to 11, says in verse 1 of Romans chapter 12, that what we ought to do in response is to present our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual, that is your non-physical worship. You worship God spiritually, you worship God in spirit by giving your body to him. And what I'd like you to think about, if you're planning on being here on Sunday mornings for the next while, is that Sunday mornings, collected together with other people of like mind, can be an opportunity to formally start each week with the formal experience of doing Romans 12:1, of presenting your body to God. And the way you sing the songs, and what's going on in your heart when you're singing them, and the way you listen to the scripture being read, the way you pray along when the praying is being prayed, the way you listen to the sermon, can be a presenting yourself to God. And that would be a good way to start every week. And then what happens after that? Well, Romans 12:1 ought to be tied in with the effect of Romans 12:1, which is Hebrews 13, verses 15 to 16, where the writer says, through him then, through Jesus then, let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God, not just Sunday mornings. Sunday mornings is the start of the week, so okay, starting with Sunday morning, but then continually you offer up a sacrifice of praise to God. That is, the fruit of lips that acknowledge his name. So what you do formally as the actual beginning of the week, you do the rest of the week, a person who's praising God, a person who's acknowledging his name. And not just that way, But our worship goes on, as the writer says, do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. So the formal presentation of your body to God in worship, say on a Sunday service, is followed by a moment-by-moment, hour-by-hour, day-by-day experience of sharing with people what you've got and doing good to them. This is like the slave serving his master in order to serve Jesus. It's in your whole life is a sacrifice. That's a worship word. Your whole week is an offering of a sacrifice of praise. It's a gift of worship to God. So my encouragement to you would be, as a project, to plan to be actually here on Sunday. I'm speaking to those who plan to be physically here. If you're planning to be physically here on Sunday mornings, 9:15 and 11 starting next week, then plan to be wholeheartedly here. Plan to be here in body and spirit, giving yourself to God. Let God hear you saying in your heart, here I am, here I am. Another whole week, and I give myself to you. And by the blood of Christ, you can be holy. And by the righteousness of Christ, you can be acceptable. And you give yourself in worship to God. And then you live a life accordingly. And one more thing. Along with learning to worship God better by making the most of Sunday worship services, let me encourage you to learn to worship God better by making the most of a daily personal time with God. So what difference would it make? This was our question with which we started. What difference would it make if every day or most days of the ministry year ahead, September on through until next summer, if most days you started the day with some sort of private, formal presentation of yourself to God? It can start the moment you wake up and realize that you are you. Oh yeah, I'm living my life. This is a great trick. This is like way more than just like a trick in terms of its benefits. Here's what I suggest. You gotta have an alarm clock to do this. The alarm clock goes off. Absolutely refuse to be a snooze button person. And here's what you do. When the alarm goes off, get your arms out of bed. Now, conveniently, most of you need to get your arms out of bed to turn the alarm off. But now your arms are out of bed, your body starts to cool, and it becomes thinkable to get out of bed. But before you do anything else, except you've turned off your alarm, you've got your arms out of bed, say something to God, acknowledging his name, acknowledging his greatness. Give him some praise. And then swing your legs out of bed. And don't stand up too fast or you'll fall over and hurt yourself. But sit there on the edge of your bed because you're moving fast here. And do it again. Acknowledge God. Thank him for something. Thank him that you can get out of bed. Thank him for the day ahead. And then I would recommend go to the bathroom and turn the coffee pot on. And then, just taking care of business. And then, sit down for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, this is most days. It can't happen every day. And you shift workers have to be really imaginative of how you make this happen every day when you're on shift. But you can work it out. At the end of sleep, arms out, praise God. Sit up, praise God. Put the coffee on, go to the bathroom. And then sit down somewhere with your coffee and your Bible and your journal and spend 5 or 10 or 15 minutes just hearing from God in his word and talking to God about what you hear. It's like starting your day 20 minutes early on purpose. It can make an enormous difference to you pulling off the Romans 12:1 and the Hebrews 13, 15, and 16 thing. Every day for Jesus. Every day serving the people in your life as a way of serving Jesus. And this is what it means to worship God better. This is what God calls us to do. And if a whole lot of us are having a September like that, we'll get the ministry year off to a great launch because we'll be people filled with the Spirit, devoted to Jesus, abiding in the Word, walking by the Spirit, getting a whole lot of things right while getting a few things wrong, because that's just life.